This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. This week, the American Astronomical Society, the AAAS, I guess, met in Nashville, and there was, of course, a lot of news about astronomy coming out of it. One team of astronomers reported on a supernova factory. Now, that's a region where two galaxies are colliding, producing an abundance of exploding stars. Another research team announced that planets may form around distant stars much quicker than previously thought. And both groups of scientists used radio telescopes to make their observations because radio telescopes are much better at peering through dense clouds of dust and gas to find interesting things. So today we're going to get a report from this week's meeting. And if you'd like to join our discussion about the cosmos, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you're invited to surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to today's topic. Let me introduce my guest. Lynn Kaminsky is the Deputy Press Officer for the American Astronomical Society and a Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Sonoma State University in Rohnert Park, California. And she joins us today by phone from Raleigh, North Carolina, where the meeting has been taking place. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Kaminsky.
Thanks, Ira. It's great to be here. But the meeting was actually in Nashville, Tennessee.
Is that where it was?
Right.
Oh, okay. I thought for sure it was in Raleigh. Okay. Let's talk about some of the news from the meeting. Exciting meeting?
It was a very good meeting. There were over 600 astronomers there. And as usual, we had our full complement of press conferences. Three of the stories, I think, are what we're going to talk about today.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the supernova factory first. What is a supernova factory?
Well, the supernova factory is a region in space where many supernova are occurring. In this case, one goes off just about every year in a very small section of space that's maybe only 30 light years across.
Mm-hmm. And why is this an important discovery?
Well, in the case of this particular supernova factory, we believe that the stars were all formed at the same time, about 8 million years ago, when these two galaxies collide to make this structure known as ARP-299. And since the very massive stars don't live very long, now they're all starting to blow up at the same time as well. Now, in our galaxy, by contrast, in an area that's maybe 100,000 light years across, we only expect to see one supernova every 50 to 100 years. So the fact that in this little tiny region in space, we have one supernova going off every 1 to 2 years, that's why we call it a supernova factory.
Wow.
The conditions very different than our own galaxy.
Well, what create the conditions then for having such fireworks of supernova?
Well, we believe it's the merger of these two galaxies has made a condensation of dust and gas that's just perfect to trigger star formation.
Mm-hmm. Are they old stars that are dying?
Well, they're not that old.
Yeah.
Stars that are 8 million years old are actually quite young, but the most massive stars only live that long before they blow up.
Mm-hmm. So how often, you know, you said that you see this once every few years. Could there be other places that you can look for the same kind of rapid supernova factory?
There are other places where galaxies are merging, and we see these little superstar clusters, but most of them are much further away than ARP-299. It's only about 140 million light years away, and that's really very close. You know, when the universe was much younger, the galaxies were closer together, and they spent more time smashing into each other and merging. So in the nearby universe, say only 140 million light years away, like ARP-299, we don't expect to see too many merging galaxies, and so this particular cluster offers us the best opportunity to really focus in and get detailed images of what's going on inside these dense and dusty clouds.
And so what can this tell us? What can a supernova factory like this tell us about anything about the life and death of our universe?
Well, we'd certainly like to understand how star formation is triggered by galaxies that are merging. For example, our own galaxy is a little dwarf galaxy is merging into our galaxy right now, and eventually our galaxy will merge with the Andromeda galaxy, otherwise known as M31, which is heading towards us. But it won't be for a few billion years, so I don't think we have that much to worry about.
Mm-hmm. How come you can't see these? I mentioned there's a lot of dust there. Could we see these with the Hubble telescope at all?
Now, that was one of the neatest things about the press conferences that we had at this meeting. None of the really big stories came in the visible light range of the electromagnetic spectrum. Most of the really exciting results came from radio or gamma rays. And in the case of the supernova factory, the observations were done by Dr. Susan Neff from Goddard Space Flight Center and Dr. Jim Alvestad of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. And what they did was they used a network of radio telescopes that is as big as the entire Earth. There are 10 radio telescopes stretched out across the entire planet, and they added the signals together from these radio telescopes to make one big telescope equivalent the size of the Earth, which allowed them to make really high-resolution pictures.
Wow, that's interesting. So you don't need to create a giant telescope. You just string a lot of them together.
Right. This is called Very Long Baseline Array.
Right.
And the resolution that they can get is about 1/30th, as 30 times better than that from the Hubble Space Telescope. So they can see fine structures that Hubble could not resolve.
Right.
But more importantly, Hubble invisible light, you cannot see inside of these enshrouded areas where you have all this dust and gas. So you can't really see stars forming and new supernova being born like they saw here.
1-800-989-8255 is our number, talking about news about astronomy with Lynn Kaminsky. Let's move on to these gamma ray news report. There was also some very interesting gamma ray burster news. Tell us what those are and what the interesting stuff that was being reported.
Well, gamma ray bursts are the biggest explosions that are occurring in the universe today. And for a long time, they were discovered about 30 years ago. For a long time, people had no idea what they are. Now we're beginning to understand ways in which these explosions could be occurring. And that is, it's very similar to a supernova, but since astronomers like to hype things, this is even bigger than a supernova, so we call it a hypernova.
Do they really? No.
Well, we were running out of superlatives.
A hypernova.
So if you have a star, say, that starts out about 100 times the mass of our sun,
right,
and it blows up, the core that it leaves behind can collapse all the way down and make a black hole. And so that's what we believe is happening in these gamma ray bursts. We're seeing the birth of a black hole every time we see a gamma ray burst, and they happen about once a day somewhere in the universe.
Mm-hmm. And these have always been typically very difficult to pinpoint where they were coming from.
Right. For most of the past 30 years, we haven't had the technology to figure out the locations of these things very accurately. But we do now, and we've got a couple satellites up there that are looking at gamma ray bursts. One of them is called HETI 2, or the High Energy Transient Explorer, number 2. And it found a burst on March 29th of this year that was the gamma ray burst of the decade. It was the brightest burst. It was about 5 times closer than we typically see these things. And so a close gamma ray burst is about 2 billion light years away. Most of these things happen out at the edge of the universe about 10 billion light years from here.
Mm-hmm. So in what range do we see them on the Hubble, or we're using radio telescopes again to see these?
Well, one of the observations, of course, the initial observations are done in gamma rays. HETI-2 is a gamma ray satellite. But then what happens after the thing explodes is you have what's called afterglow radiation. So you've got a big fireball, and then something is cooling down. And you can watch the cooling embers from the burst as it cools down and makes X-rays and then visible light, and Hubble can take a picture at that point. And radio light as well comes from the shock from this big fireball.
And so did you actually discover for the first time in these cases what drives these gamma ray bursts?
Well, the radio observations were very important in trying to decide about the exact mechanism for what's happening after the explosion takes place. And this is also using very long baseline array. This work was done by Dale Frail at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory and his colleagues. And what they were able to do is actually resolve the jet that's being shot out of this thing as the explosion continues. So they were actually able to measure the jet, resolve it using this very accurate and nice imaging system, and then they were able to see that the jet did not move. And that's very important in the fireball model, because if the thing is exploding and you've got a jet beaming at you, it should stay in the same place as the jet continues on its way.
Well, having a jet would mean that something has to be directing it all in that one jet-like direction, does it not?
Right. And so that was the other exciting part of this press conference, where was the first detection of polarization in the gamma rays themselves. It was a different burst, one that happened in December of 2002, and it was observed by a different gamma ray satellite, the Ramadi Solar Imager, which is actually spending most of its time looking for solar flares from our sun. But in the case of this particular gamma ray burst that was studied by Dr. Steve Boggs and his postdoc Wayne Coburn from UC Berkeley, this burst came from right past the edge of the sun, so they happened to be looking in the right direction to see it. Mm-hmm. And when the gamma rays came into their detector, they were able to tell that all the photons were lined up the same way. They were all polarized in the same direction. Mm-hmm. And that's really strange if you think about it. You've got this huge thing exploding. Why on earth would something want to stay lined up in a jet or, you know,
right.
in a fireball that's
right.
expanding? You'd expect a lot of disorder, a lot of turbulence. So that led them to conclude that there were very strong magnetic fields that were being shot out of the at the same time as the explosion occurred, and these magnetic fields were somehow wrapping themselves around this jet and keeping everything aligned as the explosion proceeded and the jet moved towards you.
Wow. Wow, so that was a great discovery in itself.
Well, people did not expect this
yeah.
polarization. It was really quite amazing that they were able to detect almost 100% polarization. I believe the figure is 80%, plus or minus 20.
And what would cause the polarization? The magnetic field, you say, caused, but, I mean, how would that...
Right. Well, the magnetic field, if it's wrapped around a stream of material, will keep everything flowing the same way, keep all the photons pointing their polarization axes the same way.
You mean like a tunnel?
Like a tunnel.
No kidding. That can happen.
Or like something, you know, like string winding around something. The magnetic field can wind around this flow of collimated matter.
That's interesting. Let me go to a phone call or two. Sarah in Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Thank you. Well, this is maybe very simplistic. It goes back to early in your program, which is fascinating. How can galaxies merge if everything is going away from everything else and everything is expanding?
Yeah.
Well, that's why galaxies don't merge as often in the nearby universe as they did in the distant universe, because now the distance between the galaxies is much further. So it doesn't happen as often, but it still happens because you have galaxies in clusters, and clusters of galaxies are gravitationally bound. All the galaxies within a cluster are bound to each other, and so that cluster itself does not expand. It doesn't participate in the general expansion of the universe.
Oh, my goodness. Well, then we're also going to cluster, but it'll be 500 million years away, right?
We hope so.
So the galaxies in our little local group are also bound to each other, but they're not going to be hitting each other any time that we have to worry about it.
Well, thank you. It's just such a mysterious, amazing, wonderful place, isn't it?
Well,
thank you very much.
Thanks for calling, Sarah.
Bye.
Do you get as excited as our listeners do?
Well, I sure do, or I wouldn't have been doing this kind of stuff for so long. I think it's very exciting that we can learn so much about the universe and that we have these fabulous instruments like the gamma ray satellites and like the Very Large Baseline Array that will allow us to make these really high-precision measurements of things that are hundreds of millions to billions of light years away from us.
All right, Lynn, stay with us a little while longer because we're going to come back after a short break and take more of our listener questions. Talking with Lynn Kaminsky, Deputy Press Officer for the American Astronomical Society, talking about the recent meeting that just concluded, about interesting news about astronomy. Stay with us. We'll come back and take your phone calls. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about the latest astronomy news with my guest, Lynn Kaminsky, Deputy Press Officer for the American Astronomical Society. Dr. Kaminsky is also Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Sonoma State University in Rohnert Park, California. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Another interesting bit of news out of the meeting, Dr. Kaminsky, is that one group of scientists is saying that planets may form around their stars much faster than previously expected.
Planet formation is something we'd really like to understand because the only solar system that we really know well is the one that we're in. So most of our theories about how planets form come from looking at our own solar system. Of course, with the recent work by people like Jeff Marcy and Paul Butler, we've discovered that our solar system is very unusual compared to the ones that they've been finding. So people have broadened their view, and they're looking at the things that come before planets to try to figure out how the planets form, to try to understand just how unusual our solar system is or isn't.
How do they arrive at the conclusion, though, that they're forming faster than we thought they were?
Well, this was work that was done by Dr. Elizabeth Lotta and Dr. Carl Heisch, and they were using a microwave telescope, which is very close to a radio telescope, just a little bit more energetic. And what they were doing was using the microwave data to look at many different stars within molecular clouds where the stars would have big disks of dust and gas swirling around them. And when they look at these objects with the microwave telescope, what they can see are the disks around the stars as long as the dust and gas are still in the disks. And in particular, they're very sensitive to the dust. So what they did was they studied many different clusters that had lots of stars in them, each cluster sort of like the ones we were talking about before with the supernova factory. And presumably the stars are roughly the same age in each cluster, but the different clusters they looked at were all different ages. And what they found is when they looked at older clusters, ones that were 3 million years old, for example, instead of, say, just 1 million year old, they didn't have very much material in the form of dust around these stars anymore. By the time they got to 5 million year old clusters, the disks were basically totally gone.
Wow.
So that was very surprising because people thought it took at least 10 million years for the dust in these disks to glob together and make little globules, and then the globules will glob together and make little things that are not quite as big as a planet called a planetesimal. And then eventually some planetesimals will glob together and turn, you know, into objects that are as big as things that we would call planets.
Mm-hmm.
And once the dust starts to glob together, they can no longer see it with the microwave telescopes. And so that's the sign that the dust is disappearing and that this beginning building block formation of the planets has started.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Was there any talk at all reported in other areas about, you know, what is considered to be two-thirds of the universe now made up of dark energy? I mean, any news about what that might be?
Actually, we did have a press conference the very first day where we heard reports from both of the two leading groups that are competing against each other in the search to understand dark energy in the universe. That's the HIZ supernova team. We heard from Dr. Bob Kirshner and the Supernova Cosmology Project. We heard from Rob Knopp and Saul Perlmutter. And they both showed their most recent data about the dark energy. They're both in agreement with each other that about 73% of the universe is in the form of this dark energy. And it's about 2-to-1 dark energy to dark matter at the current level of understanding and confidence.
So 3/4 of the universe is dark energy that we can't see and have no idea what it is.
Right. And their new studies are to try to figure out some more of the properties of the dark energy. And it's sort of complicated, but there's several different theories for what dark energy could be. One theory is simply what used to be called the cosmological constant. This is the thing that Einstein made up to try to fix his equations to keep the universe from expanding or collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
Einstein really believed in a static universe, and he was very upset when his equations for general relativity implied the universe would either expand or collapse. So he put in this cosmological constant, which is just a big fudge factor, to try to keep that from happening. Then shortly thereafter, they discovered the universe was, in fact, expanding, and so then he called that the biggest blunder he had ever made.
Yeah, Hubble came along and said, uh-oh. It's
right.
So,
but this dark energy, this cosmological constant, has now been revived and is some type, if you believe in the original Einstein sort of interpretation, it's some kind of vacuum energy that's constant and is driving the acceleration of the universe to expand even faster than we believe just with looking at it from Hubble.
It sounds like the ether is returning.
Well,
remember? Well, 100 years ago, they said, what is light propagated? It must be the ether because it needs a medium, right?
Well, the problem with that is that all the experiments that people did to try to find the ether, they could never find it. In this case, we have lots of evidence for the existence of dark energy, and we also have lots of evidence that you can have pairs of particles emerge out of the vacuum and go back away again. And so, you know, they don't live for very long, then they recombine and disappear back into the vacuum. And so there are at least a couple of the ingredients, you know, that make the thing a real physical theory instead of just ether.
I don't, you know, it's a mind-blowing thing to we lay people to think that 75% of the universe is stuff we can't see. You know, we go outside, we look at the stars, the planets, all the things that are visible. We think that's the universe, but three-quarters of it is
dark energy. The next large amount of stuff that we don't know what it is dark matter.
So we're talking.
So there's only 5% of the stuff in the entire universe is the stuff that we experience on
right.
a daily basis.
Wow,
it's rather humbling.
It is rather humbling. Think only 5% of the universe, and do we know what the dark matter is?
No, we don't know what the dark matter is either. But at least with the dark matter, we can feel it, even though we can't see it. So we can feel its gravitational effects on other bodies that have mass, like ourselves and galaxies and things.
Wow. So we're in the dark about a lot of this stuff.
It's a very dark universe, and it's getting stranger all the time.
Well, the scientists like that. I mean, isn't the joy in the chase, in the hunt? When you find it, it's done.
I mean, right. And so every time we think we have something figured out, it just gets curiouser and curiouser, to quote Alice in Wonderland, and we find out that there really isn't very much we understand at all about the universe that we live in.
Anything new about, you know, the theory that was a few months ago about the speed of light had been different toward the beginning of the universe?
No, there weren't any results at this particular meeting about changes or possible changes in the speed of light. Some people think that if you can change some of the things that we believe are constant, like the speed of light, that it's just that type of effect, or modifications to gravity, for example, on very large scales, those type of effects could mimic some of the things that we interpret as dark matter or dark energy.
Mm-hmm. So,
but most of the tests that people have done, for example, of modified Newtonian dynamics, have not borne fruit. So we're
right.
back to the same old problems of not understanding what type of universe we're living in.
Well, that's a good place to end it, because now we're all in the same boat. Lynn Kaminsky, thank you very much for joining us. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, I'm sure I'll be back again.
You certainly will.
In another year or so.
Well, no, hopefully before then. Thanks a lot. Have a good weekend. Lynn Kaminsky is the Deputy Press Officer for the American Astronomical Society and Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Sonoma State University in Rohnert Park, California.